Australia is the greatest nation on earth. And at the referendum last year, Australians told the elites they want to keep it that way. Is 2024 the year mainstream Australians continue to secure our way of life, or will the elites strike back? In season 3 of Australia's Future, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott will share his unique insight on the future of the Australian way of life. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Today, we'll be discussing the upcoming Dunkley by-election and Tony's experience with by-elections and what they mean for the government and the opposition. We will be discussing the energy situation in Australia on the back of 500,000 homes being blacked out in Victoria. And Tony will also share his thoughts and perspective on being in India recently and the future that India holds for the democratic nations of the world. Tony, great to be back.
Dan, as always, lovely to be with you.
Great. Well, let's start with the Dunkley by-election up this Saturday. Labor holds it on just over 6%. It's widely expected that Labor will retain it, but with a swing against it. Now, in your time in government, Tony, you technically had two by-elections. You had the Griffith by-election, which was in Kevin Rudd's old seat on the 8th of February 2014. Now, there was a swing to the government of just over 2%, which was unusual for that to take place. Then you had the Canning by-election that was held just a few days after you were deposed as Prime Minister. Now, that was a hold to the government, but with a 6.5% swing against the coalition. But of course, you won Canning in 2013 with a 9.5% swing towards it. So you're up net three, still there. So, Tony, talk us through the politics of by-elections. Are they a referendum on the government and on the leader at the time, or are they more about local issues? What's your sort of experience?
Look, it's a bit of both. Griffith was a relatively safe Labor seat, which Kevin Rudd was vacating. There was a good Labor candidate. There was an outstanding coalition candidate in Dr. Bill Glasson. But nevertheless, it was a hold by the opposition with a modest swing to the then government. Canning was a different story. We had the previous local member die in office. We had a great candidate in Andrew Hastie. But of course, just a week before the by-election, there'd been a change of Prime Minister, which plainly doesn't normally reflect well on the government of the day. So, look, by-elections are a mixed bag. I think they tend to be an opportunity for people to cast a bit of a protest vote. And just at the moment, I certainly would expect some protest vote against the Albanese government. The Prime Minister obviously expects a big protest vote. That's why he's constantly saying that the average by-election swing against a government is 7%. He's clearly taking out insurance against the possibility of a big swing or even a defeat come Saturday night. Now, frankly, the PMs talk about a 7% average swing against governments at by-elections is, shall we say, self-serving. If you look at the average swing since 2009, it's been more in the order of under 1%. There's been quite a few by-elections. I guess the result was slightly skewed by all of those constitutional by-elections over the disqualification of members on account of foreign citizenship. But even if you take all of that out, and even if you exclude the Aston by-election, which was a big swing to the government last year because the honeymoon factor was still at work, the average anti-government swing in by-elections since 2009 is less than 3%. So, look, anything over a 3% swing against the government on Saturday night, I reckon, is a pretty bad result for Labor. And there's a couple of other factors here. Cost of living is the only issue in town. Power bills have gone up 20% on the Prime Minister's watch, despite his claim that he would deliver a $275 per household per year cut. I think the government is sitting on bad news, such as an up to 6% rise in private health insurance premiums, which should have been dealt with by early February at the latest, but which is being delayed. Then there's this whole question of the default market offer, which could easily result in a multi-billion dollar further taxpayer subsidy to renewable energy producers, which yep. is going to come out of consumers' pockets one way or another, either in prices or in taxes. So I think this is a government which knows it's in a degree of trouble. I don't think the public have forgiven the government for breaking its Stage 3 tax cut commitment.
Yep.
I know the Prime Minister is saying at the moment that his decision was the right policy for the right reasons. Well, if that's the case, how can it be so right now when it was so wrong for the previous 5 years?
Yep.
The Prime Minister said over 100 times that he was completely committed to these Stage 3 tax cuts. Then, of course, almost like a would-be gift to the electors of Dunkley, he suddenly dumped that commitment. Well, I suspect that the electors of Dunkley are a little bit more sophisticated than some of the Labor strategists think. So, look, we won't know until Saturday night, but plainly the government is running scared.
Yeah, I mean, let's just pick up on that point of trust in politicians. So it does seem to be the case that, you know, so far the gamble, as such as it is, hasn't paid off.
Yeah.
I mean, basically it's stopped the decline in the polls for Albanese. It looks like it has, but there is a big price to be paid for that. My view on it when he first broke the promise was I didn't think it would be a big deal because cynicism in politicians is already so high that people just factor in that they're going to break a promise at some point. Perhaps, though, it being so brazen and so obviously political grated against people. I'm just interested in your perspective, Tony.
Look, the old phrase, Dan, the standard you walk by is the standard you accept. I know that the public are a bit cynical about politicians, but if they don't punish politicians who do the wrong thing, plainly they are encouraging politicians to keep doing the wrong thing. Now, as a former politician, as a former Prime Minister, I hope that the public approach politics in a spirit of generosity, if you like. But it's one thing for a politician to make a commitment under one set of circumstances, and when circumstances change, changing the commitment. But when that happens, you've got to be absolutely upfront with the public. You've generally got to say, well, look, that's what I thought then. I'm sorry, but things have changed. This is what I think now.
Yeah.
And if it's a big enough change, as, for instance, with John Howard on the GST, you've really got to seek a new mandate. As you'll remember, John Howard went to the 1996 election saying that there would never, ever be a GST. Come 1998, he and Peter Costello had changed their minds, and then they sought a mandate at the 1998 election, which they duly got, albeit with a reduced majority. Now, that's the honest, upfront, and decent way to go about a significant change of policy. And that's certainly the polar opposite of the way the current government has gone about these things. So look, the public aren't silly. The public accept that things do change, but I think they also have a right to expect a degree of candour and straightness from their leaders, and that's not what they've been getting lately.
Yep, well, like you see, we'll find out on Saturday just how hard they're going to punish the Prime Minister. But I think the current thinking is anything sort of a 4% swing or more is a pretty big endorsement of Peter Dutton and rejection of the Prime Minister. So we'll see how that goes. Moving to the next topic, Tony, is the energy system. So only a week or two ago, we had blackouts in Victoria, about 500,000 houses lost power. Now, the notional reason for that was the collapse of 6 or 7 transmission towers. But that gets back to the fundamental point that we have a government at the state level and increasingly at the federal level that's not focused on reliability. They're putting emissions reductions and climate ideology in front of everything else. And that's the real cause of, or that's the political cause of why this has happened. from my perspective, the energy system continues to get worse. And I think it's almost inevitable that we're going to have a situation where a government just simply has to underwrite baseload power supply, because no private investor is going to build new coal stations or extend the life of existing ones because of the bad policy arrangements around it. So clearly something has to change. Tony, you got rid of the carbon tax, and when you got rid of that, energy bills came down immediately, and you can see that in the Australian Bureau of Statistics data. So just interested in your perspective on, you know, if you were leader, if you were involved in the energy system, what would you do to make sure that the lights stay on and the bills come down?
Dan, what happened in Victoria a fortnight back, sure, was triggered by a collapse of the transmission towers. But the basic problem is Victoria does not have enough electricity. And when the collapse of the transmission towers triggered the outage of the largest coal-fired power station, there just wasn't enough power to go around because wind and solar can't ramp up in the way that coal or gas can ramp up at need. So that's the basic problem. And while the immediate blackout was the direct consequence of a weather event, later in that day, because of a lack of available power, there was further load shedding as an act of policy by the energy market operator. So plainly, we do need to have more reliable power in our system. And the only reliable power that we've got, I suppose we've got about 10% of hydro, is the 10% or thereabouts of gas that we've got in the system, and the 60% plus of coal that we've still got in the system on normal times. Our basic fundamental problem is that for the best part of two decades, with a little interruption when I was in the top job, the power system has been run not to produce affordable and reliable energy, but to reduce emissions. Now, hence the almost obsessive move towards wind and solar power, which only produces electricity when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining. I think that energy policy is just going from bad to worse. Right now, we've got the federal government paying out $1 billion in subsidies to coal generators to try to keep power prices down. You've got the Victorian government subsidising coal generators so that we don't lose the Portland smelter and 1,000-plus jobs. But we're about to have this default market offer to renewable generators. And God knows how much that's going to cost. At the moment, the government's not putting any figures on it because they say they don't want to warp the market. But almost certainly, if we're going to give a guaranteed price so that we can create what currently doesn't exist, an extra 32 megawatts of wind and solar generation, which is just a massive amount, we're talking here about many, many, many billions of dollars. So the folly of all this is we once had a system that gave us amongst the lowest power prices in the world, based almost exclusively on coal with a bit of gas and a bit of hydro. It worked very well. It was reliable, affordable power. Then the emissions obsession kicks in. Almost all of the new generation over the last couple of decades has been wind and solar. First of all, we subsidised the wind and the solar. And then we start subsidising the coal. And now we're going back to subsidising the wind and the solar, when before we had a perfectly good system that was entirely unsubsidised. Now, this is the very midsummer of madness, and yet it's not going to change until we have a government which is absolutely clear-headed about what it is trying to do, and that should be power that is both affordable and reliable. And let's not worry too much about emissions because they were declining anyway as we move to more efficient gas, more efficient coal-fired power stations and to a greater use of gas.
We had the high-efficiency, low-emissions coal stations that I believe were pioneered in Japan, and there was an argument, at least 10, I think when you were Prime Minister, about setting up new ones, and unfortunately I don't think that's gone ahead. So there's plenty of new technology over the last couple of decades.
And if over the last 15 years we had been renewing our coal-fired fleet, as would normally have been the case, the newer stations would be giving out 40% to 50% less emissions than the older stations. And, of course, gas is about 50% lower emissions than coal anyway. Mm-hmm. So just in the normal course of events, we would be getting substantially lower emissions, but we wouldn't have the reliability and affordability problems that we've got now, because, I mean, the fundamental problem with wind and solar is that it only operates about 30% of the time on average. So you've got to have so-called firming, gas, batteries, pumped hydro, if it ever actually happens, to chip in when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. But all this redundancy is vastly expensive. And then you've got to have all these extra transmission lines for a decentralized system. And as we're discovering, not only do people find the forests of wind towers and the fields of solar panels the modern version of the dark satanic mills, so they're grotesquely unaesthetic, but they also take up an enormous amount of land. Yep. I mean, something like half the state of Victoria would be covered by wind turbines and solar panels if we are to get to the 82% of renewables that the government insists we must within just 6 years.
Yeah, that's right. So from a policy perspective, so you've outlined the fundamental problem, which is essentially the almost incessant and sole focus on cutting emissions. What kind of policies would you suggest going forward to government in terms of how do we return to a system that's based on reliable, affordable energy with baseload power?
I have been carefully looking at the statements and speeches of key people in the opposition, and my sense from speeches that Ted O'Brien, the energy shadow, has given is that the sort of thing that the coalition will come up with at some appropriate time before the election is no more coal-fired power to retire until there's a reliable alternative, rapid development of new gas fields, not just for domestic use, but to ensure that we can continue to give resource security to our trusted partners like Japan, no further subsidies for new renewables, make renewables stand on their own two feet rather than giving them an unfair advantage, and an end to the ban on nuclear. Now, even if the ban on nuclear was abolished tomorrow, it would be 5 years plus before we could hope to get nuclear power stations into the mix. But part of the folly of the current policy is that we are gung-ho to get nuclear power at sea, but we're apparently absolutely opposed to nuclear power on land. The irrationality and the inconsistency of having a nuclear reactor tied up at the dock here, and that's great, but a nuclear reactor erected on the other side of the dock there, that's terrible. It just doesn't stand up to serious scrutiny, and yet that's the current policy position of our government, and it has to change.
Well, let's turn now to a country that's not crippling itself with emissions obsessions, and they're quite happy, understandably, to use coal-fired power as the basis of their industrial development and growth, which is India.
Yeah.
You've had a lot to do with India over many years. You've been a champion of their economic development of them as a democracy, as someone who may be critical in, you know, the balance of power as it relates to China and international relations issues. You were there recently. I believe you just arrived back this morning or last night from there. So we appreciate you coming in here to give us first crack at what you've been talking about over in India. So could you just share with our viewers and listeners what you were doing in India and perhaps what you learned over there?
Dan, thanks. I was at a quite important annual conference, the Raisina Dialogue, which is India's answer to things like Davos and the Bao Forum, which China runs.
Yep.
The great thing about the Raisina Dialogue is that it is quite a significant global meeting place. Mm. And unlike Bao, it's not just a all hail to the chief kind of thing. There is a genuine dialogue on the platform. People are allowed to have different views.
Yep.
And so it's really quite a lively exchange that goes on there. So I was there. I then attended a university convocation, then was at another conference there on Monday. I've tried to make India a big focus of my post-parliamentary life in the same way that people like Bob Hawke and Paul Keating made China a big focus of theirs, because I do think that India was always a much more natural partner for Australia than China. Apart from anything else, India is a democracy with the rule of law and to a great extent the English language. Then there are the considerable ties of history. Mm. People normally forget that Indian soldiers were our brothers in arms at Gallipoli. Indian soldiers fought with us in North Africa, mm-hmm. In the Second World War. The first commercial shipment from the infant colony back in 1795 was to Bengal. Supplies from India kept us going in the lean years after the First and Second Fleets. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a history. And of course, we've now got something like 1 million Australians of Indian background and an increasing economic relationship, which will only get stronger thanks to the trade deal, which Narendra Modi and I started back in 2014 and which was brought to at least an interim conclusion in 2022. As we all know, Dan, the strategic balance is changing. Mm-hmm. America's economic and military weight in the world is relatively declining. China's is relatively increasing. China is absolutely explicit about its desire to be the world's number one power, the global hegemon, if you like, by mid-century. The only real counterweight to China is India.
Mm.
And while India has a tradition of non-alignment, that is changing under Narendra Modi. I don't expect India to be in any kind of formal military alliance with America anytime soon. But nevertheless, the quadrilateral security dialogue linking India, Australia, Japan, and the United States is, I believe, the most significant geostrategic development since the creation of NATO 6 or 7 decades back. And I think it needs to be fostered at every possible opportunity. As I said, it's not a military alliance. It's not a formal arrangement. It's an informal partnership. It's a network of the like-minded.
Mm.
But over time, it's going to be very significant in deterring China from adventurism in our region. And that's why it's, I think, really important for people like me and indeed for the Australian government to do everything we can at every level to boost that relationship and to let the Indians know that they are valued for their own sake, that we respect and appreciate their leadership and their importance rather than simply trying to recruit them to our purposes.
Mm. What more might be done then in that context? Is it mostly about economic ties and free trade deals? Is it a security type arrangement? What more, in your judgment, could be done from the Australian government's vantage point to strengthen that relationship?
Well, to be honest, I think that we could be more heavily represented at things like the Raisina Dialogue.
Mm.
The Indian government regards this as an important showcase.
Mm-hmm.
Their very impressive foreign minister, Jaishankar, is an absolutely avid attender
mm-hmm.
at almost all of the sessions. Prime Minister Modi comes always to the opening session, not to make a speech himself, but to listen to the key international speaker as a sign of respect.
Mm.
So I think we could be more heavily represented there.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, Foreign Minister Penny Wong was briefly there. This year, Veterans Affairs Minister Matt Keogh was there, and good on them for what they have done. But I would think that it would be a smart move by the Australian government to have at least one cabinet-level minister there every year.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a good thing for the Prime Minister to make himself available should the dialogue wish to have an Australian Prime Minister as their opening speaker. I think this is certainly one very important thing that we could do. But at every level, I just think it's important for our key people to be engaging with their equivalent on the Indian side. One thing we really need to get more of is Australian investment in India.
Mm-hmm.
And I reckon that every large Australian business should have an India strategy in the same way that once upon a time they all had a China strategy, for two reasons. A, because India is a large and underdeveloped market for Australian products. And B, because India is a prospective source of the intermediate goods that we need to have a reliable and low-cost supply chain.
Mm.
Part of the difficulty that so many countries have at the moment is that a lot of our supply chain has been outsourced to China,
yep.
which was all very well a decade or so back when we were confident that China was liberalising and was becoming more and more part of the global family. Now that we know that China is, if anything, becoming much more authoritarian
mm-hmm.
and is more and more using trade as a weapon against its strategic opponents, we do have to cut China out of our critical supply chains. We either onshore everything,
yep.
which would be extremely expensive, or we friendshore things. And if we're looking for a country where we can friendshore things, India is an obvious place to do that. And the good thing about people investing in India is that you're not going to find your assets confiscated. Mm. You're not going to find your technology stolen. You're not going to have your money trapped inside the country, as we now know can readily be the case in China. That's not to say doing business in India is always a bed of roses.
Yep.
It is different. At times it can be highly bureaucratic. Their legal system can be slow.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it is fair and there is goodwill and they will do their best to do the right thing.
I just wanted to ask you one more question before I let you go on an entirely different topic, and this is without notice, I apologise. But you and I talked early in the year about Australia Day, about our culture, and about the attacks on it by the woke corporates. Now, since we last talked, we obviously had Brad Banducci, the CEO of Woolworths, who resigned or was pushed or whatever it might be. And I think we have seen, you know, a bit of an inflection point in that debate, and I thought it was quite an important development that someone was made to pay the price mm-hmm. for demeaning and dividing our nation in that way. I just was interested in your perspective on that event and seeing Banducci go. Mm. Now, obviously, the spin from Woolworths is it had nothing to do with Australia Day. It was to do with the interview he did with the ABC and so forth. But none of that would have happened without the Australia Day event and the fact that Woolworths and other big corporates had backed The Voice. So just interested to see if you get a sense that maybe corporate Australia is starting to get the message and the lesson to stay out of these issues or whether we've still got a way to go.
Look, I suspect we still have a way to go, Dan. Yeah. And I don't want to offer any critical comment about Brad Banducci's economic stewardship of Woolworths. Mm. It seems that Woolies has done pretty well over the last few years under his leadership commercially.
Yep.
But plainly, Woolies made a big mistake getting deeply involved in the Voice campaign and then having been burnt then. Instead of learning their lesson, they doubled down on Australia Day with that ostentatious virtue signalling. So I guess one mistake is forgivable. Two mistakes of the same kind start to become pretty problematic. Mm. So again, like you, Dan, I don't know all of the factors behind his departure, but... when you stuff up big time, you should pay a price. If a politician makes too many mistakes, he or she loses endorsement, he or she loses a seat, or indeed a government gets turfed out.
Mm.
That's the way it should be. There should be consequences for bad behaviour. And one of our difficulties today is that when things go wrong, instead of identifying the culprit and imposing an appropriate punishment, we tend to say, oh, it's the system's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of changing the people who've stuffed up, we end up burdening ourselves with ever more regulation and ever more red tape, which I think is an entirely counterproductive way to proceed. So let's hope that at least in part, Woolies have made this change because they've learnt their lesson, and let's hope this turns out to be encouragement to other corporates to learn the same lesson.
Indeed, and I think it was a victory for Peter Dutton, who called the call for the boycott. There were a lot of people sceptical of it, but you got to say it worked. So thanks again for the time. I know you've been jet-setting around, so appreciate you coming in here for this chat, and very much looking forward to a chat in about a fortnight or so.
Good on you, Dan.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.